I should have turned it on before, and I'm still getting used to this thing. It's the new piece of technology. It's an honor and privilege to be here. I've just in the last few weeks, months or two, really begin in earnest to work on a body of material that I've been developing throughout the time that I've been at PCC, and really material that had started many years before when I was living back east and had the impetus to come out here thinking that I was going to work on this book by going to school. And instead, going to school kind of took me away from it, and then Planet Works taking me away from it, a whole lot of things. And I finally kind of pulled back from all the other stuff I'm doing to really focus on this. And which has also meant putting together a whole slew of PowerPoints that you're not going to see tonight. But I may need to show you a few images just because it's kind of hard to get some of what I'm talking about without some of the graphics, particularly some things that I developed over the years that sort of help you to see maps of particularly how to think about chemistry in a different way. So I'm going to kind of look at them myself, though, just to remind me of my outline, because that's how I've been working on it recently. My major thesis is reframing two and then eventually three different, radically different worldviews. And the first two that I want to kind of point to, the first one would say we're headed towards catastrophe, basically reverse course. So it's the sort of hard environmental state of the world, World Watch, WRI, limits to growth kind of argument. And that argument is often framed basically in terms of slow down or change direction. Like, you know, we're going in a dangerous direction too fast, we've got to change direction. Juxtaposed to that is what I would call the sort of Silicon Valley, VC, kind of globalization capitalist perspective, which basically says, no problem, the market and technology will fix it. And I would describe this as sort of the market is God, which is like blind faith in the market as the intervening force that will save us from ourselves. And I would see those as sort of opposite each other, and then I would frame a third kind of wild card viewpoint, which has become particularly, I think in most of our view, dangerously prominent in this country, and it comes in other forms. And that would be more or less, you know, what problem? Jesus is coming. The sort of fundamentalist viewpoint that somehow says the crisis that's coming is something we welcome because it fits into our prophetic framework in this way, and we're sure we know what it means. So there are certainly other worldviews, but I want to pick those three out as three prominent strands in the world. And then if I was doing this with slides, actually I'm gonna keep in the order I would have gone, and I'm gonna just show you one image that I need to talk about for a bit to sort of get you oriented before I go into some other things. This is a version of the periodic table. And I did this about 20 years ago when I was studying chemistry. And what it does is instead of putting it in a grid the way we usually see it, and this is just the inner elements, the first two rows, it takes the eightfold symmetry of chemistry and it puts it on a continuous spiral. So you start from hydrogen and then you spiral out through lithium and beryllium and boron, which are not particularly common, but to carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and then around. And so the noble gases are up here, the elements that are full. They have all eight electrons. And opposite them are carbon and silicon, which have four electrons. Mm-hmm. And what this does is it shows the sort of symmetry between the things that are full and the things that are half empty. So carbon and silicon become the building blocks of life and rock, respectively. And elements on one side very much want to give up an electron and or get an electron, and the other side really one electron. And so you could have like sodium and chlorine will form a salt, sodium chloride. And you could think of the whole thing as this impulse of things from either side to try and get to the middle. But if you're on way the other side, you're not trying to get to the middle, you sort of are the middle and other things will connect to you. So then from carbon you get nitrogen, oxygen, and then that's hydrogen. Those four elements form much of the basis of organic chemistry. Almost, you know, there's other things like phosphorus, things that you hear about from fertilizer, sulfur, but carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen form the vast preponderance of the elements that actually build life. And then silicon and alumina down here form the vast preponderance along with iron and some other elements, metals. But most of rock is silica, alumina, and oxygen. Those are the great preponderance. And I'm sort of giving this little intro at the very beginning because I didn't know where else to put it, but it's going to be useful in trying to follow some of the things I talk about throughout this, to have this little map of how to grok chemistry. And if you have a lot of chemistry, you know, it's probably cute, but if you haven't had any, it sort of forms a way of intuitively, if you have any sense of sort of the visual way of seeing things, of understanding why things would be as they are. These are the elements that are small enough and fit together and are missing just enough electrons to combine with each other. So
it's gone dark.
So? Yeah, just hit the shift key, Jim.
Yeah,
there you go.
It's going to.
It's okay.
Okay, that's as much as I'm going to do with that. So we'll come back to that, but I just wanted to sort of get it on the table. So now what I do with the slides and what I would do at this point, in this audience I probably don't need to do it tremendously, but to take us through a number of key trends that are happening in the world that are, from the point of view of probably most of the people in this room, tremendously frightening. And I think when you really think about these things in these terms, it becomes clear that it's not a question of like an environmental movement. We're really talking about the fate of the future of humanity on the planet. And these trends, any one of them by themselves could be tremendously threatening, and taken together, they seem apparently truly terrifying, and that they all seem to form right now kind of a Gordian knot. That as you kind of look out in the world, if you start paying attention to this stuff, it seems as if these things are just completely intractable. I'm going to pick out a couple that I think are worth paying special attention to, because there's a lot of ways of framing things, but these are the categories that I would point to as the big major categories. The first is population. Anybody who's seen the graph knows that it just goes like that. It just spikes. We're at 6 billion, and there's a range of projections absent, you know, global plague, that have us going to probably at least 8, and some of them just continue to take off towards 12 and 15. I don't think we can go there. If it went that way, we would, you know, really be in trouble. But here we've just brought in a pope that wants nothing more than to go. So global population remains, you know, truly terrifying. There was an interesting positive thing. I heard Ehrlich talking just in passing that in the 70s, the U.S. population suddenly sort of went below replacement much quicker than anybody thought. It's as if it just sort of flipped. And it was probably about the time his book came out, but it also was an unexpected kind of positive. And in general, the developed world, when you get affluence, people do tend to slow down. And in fact, even in the third world, if women get control of reproduction secret from men, the birth rate will come down. So there, we actually do know how we might intervene there, but if you go to the UN and talk to the male delegates from those countries, they won't go there because they think it's my life insurance, it's sort of a machismo thing. So that's one that I saw this thing go by on the PCC list, sort of this fight between the real issues in the world and feminism. Well, this is where they intersect. that one of the key issues in the world, perhaps the driver, is completely about feminism, but, you know, in a very kind of concrete, like, reproductive control level of feminism. The population is also a good example of something that has to be an S-curve. It's a curve that started out very flat. It's getting very steep. It's actually already started to slow down, but the question is how fast it can slow down and go towards sort of a plateau. And so at times you would have looked at that curve and thought it was called a logarithmic curve, a curve that takes off to infinity, and watching it far enough, we see it's a curve that actually has to come over and go towards a plateau. The next thing that I would point to is what's now being called peak oil. And this is basically the fact that the petroleum supply is limited. And we're at, whether it's this year or next year or 5 years from now, the furthest out projections that nobody really believes are about 2035 could be the peak. And some people say it was 2000. And the peak is the point where we stop discovering new reserves as fast as we're demanding them, and basically go from being awash in oil to oil becoming really structurally in short supply compared to demand on the planet. And it feels like most of the projections seem to say 2005, 2006, you know, you are there. So this is like a bell curve. The next one that is in the news a lot, even more than peak oil, is CO2, global warming. The idea that the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere has been in a pretty narrow range for all of human existence on the planet, and it's now just spiked and gone off scale. And temperature's following very steadily along with it. What you don't hear about as much as CO2 is the methane level, which is an even more potent greenhouse gas and even more frightening. And there's actually a possibility that if we heat things too much, we would liberate tremendous amounts of methane that's in the permafrost and other places, and the thing would just spiral out of control. So we could be very close to that. Even amid all of those three, the most frightening trend that is getting very little press, it was very easy to get all kinds of graphs for those off the web, you know, to take my pick. The one that was hard to even find a graphical representation of is just the sheer consumption of resources, of theoretically renewable biological resources, and the collateral destruction of habitat and extinction. And at this point, when I first seriously started studying this stuff, the late 90s, the best estimates we were using about 40% of the output of the biosphere for human purposes. The UN report that just came out says it's at 60. And that 20% change probably did happen in the last 5 years. It looks as if the doubling period is on the order of 10 years. We don't have any human intuition for how to deal with logarithmic curves that are doubling. You know, each interval it doubles. And it just, you know, because it means a few years ago, you know, if something's a few years away from being half done, a few years ago it was a 16th. You know, it's just, and that's the real source of the train wreck the fastest that nobody's paying attention to. And just very few people have any intuition for it. The last one that I would point to, which I don't put in anywhere near the same league as these, but I think is in some ways the most optimistic or the likely leverage point on the whole thing, which is the possibility of global economic instability. That on the order of 95% of currency flows or what we call trade is just speculation, the global casino. It's just money washing around, speculating, tracing its tail. On the order of 95 to 98% of the wealth in the world is owned by somewhere between 1% and 2% of the population, and that's still accelerating too. At any given moment, somewhere in the world, a whole huge piece of the world economy, the economy is going to crisis for really no reason other than just the machinations of the fiscal system. You know, there was no reason why Southeast Asia or Argentina or any number of places should have suddenly had their economy go down tubes. It wasn't their fault. It's built into the system. The thing that very few people understand really in its depth about the nature of our money system is that money is basically borrowed into existence. The way money is introduced into society is by authorizing the central banks to authorize borrowing, and then this trickles down through the system. And what it means is that basically all money in the system at any given time comes in with interest attached. And, you know, this in the old Christian tradition was usury. You know, it's the thing that the Islamic tradition still won't abide. And it, you know, you could think of it as a moral thing, but it may be that some very, you know, intelligent observations about if you construct your game rules that way, what happens? Among the things it forces is short-term time horizons. You can show mathematically that if you have positive interest and you have, you know, you can grow pines or oaks, and it takes pines 10 years and oaks 100 years to grow, and the pine's worth, you know, a tenth of the oaks. If you have positive interest, you'll always grow pines, because in 100 years, the discount rate, you're literally discounting the future, the oaks will be worth nothing, and the pines will be a huge return. On the other hand, if you have essentially the opposite of positive interest, you would always grow oaks. And in those times when they've had money systems that worked the opposite way, essentially money was like a hot potato that you could use to circulate, but you didn't want to keep it as a store of value. Two of the periods we know that worked that way were ancient Egypt, when they built the pyramids and the very long-term monuments, and medieval Europe, when they built the cathedrals. Had money systems like that, and it had the consequence of seemed to orient society towards very long-term structures. So those trends that I just pointed to, all of those trends essentially will need to be very quickly reversed if we're going to make it. And right now, looking out, it looks pretty dark. You know, sort of, how could that possibly happen? And I'm just going to leave that one hanging for a bit and talk a little bit about... It's hard to do this because I've been working the last couple of weeks so hard to get all these slides together, and I should have brought a projector.
You've got them there, people.
It's really hard because I really set them up to like do about 30 seconds a slide. I mean, they're not ones that are going to...
Next year or sometime, I have a proper screen, and you can...
My projector went to Oroville and came back dead on arrival, so I'm without one, too. So I want to talk a little about the very long-term biological evolution on the planet. Because we're used to thinking about framing things entirely within the human context. And this gives us a very short-term time horizon, and it's gotten shorter and shorter. In fact, I'm hoping that we may have just come through the shortest time horizon ever, you know, maybe around 2000. So if we look back at life on the planet and we think about, in science, the sort of unit of currency is very much energy. This is how most people in both the biological and physical sciences will measure things, is they'll watch the energy flows. There's things beyond that, particularly in biology, but energy flows will tell you a tremendous amount. So when life first evolved on the planet, there was a chemical soup that had enough potential energy in it that the first life forms were able to basically use that as their source of nourishment. And this went on for quite some time, but fairly early on, and I just heard earlier on than I'd even heard before, almost right at the beginning, life figured out how to arrange carbon atoms into molecules that could capture photons from the sun and use that energy to assemble carbon compounds. And this is a pretty amazing discovery, that we could figure out how to transform that energy. And so you could think of it as being the sort of first energy crisis that drove that need. You know, as we were using up the stash of atoms of energy available in the soup, we had to do something, and we figured out how to grab sunlight and make photosynthesis. And then photosynthesis went on for a very long time, throwing oxygen into the atmosphere. And for a very long time, that oxygen rusted all of the available iron. And so iron would get churned up to the surface, and oxygen would rust it, and it would come down. And it had to keep, as long as there was iron around to essentially buffer the atmosphere, the oxygen level stayed within bounds and rusted the iron. At a certain point, when that finally had used up all of the available iron, the oxygen level started to spike. And instead of the CO2 crisis we have now, we had an oxygen crisis. And some people speculate that the oxygen level would have gotten so high that carbon-based organisms would start spontaneously combusting. And, you know, this is a real crisis. And at that point, as far as we can tell, respiration was invented, which took advantage of the very high energy oxygen as another source of energy. And with respiration and photosynthesis, the carbon cycle was developed. And you could think of the balance in the carbon cycle as being kind of between plants and animals, where the plants are taking in CO2, building carbohydrate structures, putting out oxygen, and the animals, although they're actually a latecomer, are eating the carbohydrates, breathing out carbon dioxide, and breathing in oxygen. Now, if you actually look at the carbon cycle today, animals account for a minuscule part of it, most of it's being done by soil bacteria and fungi. The fungi are actually a lot like us. They're over with us in the balance between plants and animals on the animal side. But when humans developed technology, you know, harnessed fire and even more than that, agriculture, from the dawn of agriculture, we can actually first notice the change in the atmospheric balance. About 10 or 12,000 years ago, we can start seeing the CO2 level going up very, very slightly. Because we started taking out tree cover, moving to grasses, moving to more bovine animals. An awful lot of the CO2 coming out now is coming from our cattle, more than from our cars. And then when we get to the Industrial Revolution, we start using fossil fuels. All of our fossil fuel technologies, like hyperanimals, it's breathing in oxygen, breathing out CO2, and using the fossil reserves that plants put there over a very long time to do it. We're very used to thinking about that as a crisis. In fact, you can look at all of these trends that I just alluded to, and in general, the people coming from the sort of deep ecology or limits to growth kind of school are looking at these trends really with a lot of imagination of where it could go on the upside, and basically saying the sky is falling. And it's pretty easy to be swayed by that argument. In fact, there's a physicist who's going around now claiming that we're basically doomed, and the best thing you can do is go for sort of minimal regret strategy as humans act like basically bacteria in a petri dish, that when we grow to the edge of the petri dish, we run out of space and the population crashes, and that's what happens. And that's about as far as he can see. I mean, there's a lot of people that can't see really any other possibility. And in fact, of the people who've looked at this stuff, there pretty much isn't anybody who's really got a strong positive thing of like, this is where we could be going. And the people who tend to be very positive are the ones who tend not to have looked at all. But they're over here saying, well, you know, we just know on faith we're going to get through because we always have before. And there may be something in that argument, but it's not terribly reassuring if they haven't looked at the situation. So if we look for biological metaphors, we've also all heard people using cancer as a biological metaphor. It's the other one, sort of unlimited cell growth. The only other biological metaphor floating around other than those would be embryonic development. The only time that you have, you know, really rapid multiplication of biological material that doesn't result in sort of population crash is not at the level of like rabbits on an island or, you know, bacteria in a petri dish. It's when you're growing like a chicken embryo. And in a situation like that, the reserves that are being consumed are actually being consumed to build a structure that's going to then go to a higher level of order. And so pretty much the only possibility on the planet right now that you would want to vote for is that that's what's going on. And that our consumption of the fossil fuel reserves have to be used to build another stable system. And if you look at the S-curve that's implied with population, implied with some of these other things, if that curve is plotting not just population, but also in some sense the rate of change that we're experiencing right now, it could suggest that what's going on is that we're essentially trying to make the jump to some sort of implied plateau state, that like nature down here, and then there's the process of history that we've entered into. And when you get about there, where the, you know, it's going vertical and it feels really terrifying because it feels like the other alternative is to do that, the only other alternative is to get up and get onto some sort of plateau. And so I propose meta-nature as a name for this sort of hypothetical plateau state, and that it would infer a kind of climax technology. It would infer that coming through what's called the point of inflection, where the curve changes direction, even though the curve is still very steep for a while, it will start to level off and slow down. But that it's not slowing down to go backwards, it's going somewhere sort of forward that we want to go to. And that the characteristics of this technology would be very much like an octave of nature. And so this brings me back to that diagram of chemistry, where we saw that as you come out from the center, you get to carbon, and then you get to silicon. So in a way, silicon is kind of like an octave of carbon. And when you look at photovoltaic technology that we're now building out of silicon, it captures photons the same way that photosynthesis does. Only photovoltaics are actually an order of magnitude more efficient than photosynthesis. Photosynthesis gets about 1% of the photons for useful energy. Silicon photovoltaics get about 10%. The economists tell us it's not efficient enough, but you know, plants never listen to economists. So this is one of the most vivid illustrations I can point to of how you could sort of understand how to think about technology, that when we're making silicon photovoltaics, we're putting the puzzle together, assembling that silicon in a certain pattern. It's very unlikely that there's going to be some other pattern or some other element that you're going to do this out of. It's built into the nature of matter. It's a kind of platonic puzzle that things can only be assembled this way. And there's a realm of things that nature can assemble, and then there's a realm of things that humans can assemble that are essentially as elegant as nature. But to get there, we have to sort of descend into history and go through all of what we've undergone to get the science and technology to sort of have the recognition. And for that matter, very likely we have to set off this just incredible high-speed trajectory to sort of make the lunge to get there. And the thing that's mostly missing from that trajectory right now is the recognition of where we would want to go. And up to this point, we haven't faced enough crisis to be looking. And so the sign of sort of the point of inflection would be the point where you recognize that it looks like you're really in trouble, and start looking around, well, where could you be going? And that recognition of where you're going would itself be the thing that moved the curve, that caused it to start seeking somewhere else. So a couple of other concrete examples of pointers to metanature. One is the convergence of fuels. As you look back over history, we've gone from wood to peat to coal to oil to natural gas, and now since about 2000 it's suddenly been universally recognized we're going to hydrogen. It came out of even Bush's mouth in about 2000. Before that, it's like nobody knew. When you get to hydrogen, again, going to that spiral table, you're at the smallest, lightest, most compact element. There's nowhere else to go. If you're going to store and move energy around in matter, in chemical energy anyway, hydrogen is pretty much it. You could also use lithium, possibly, which is the other side of helium. It's got an atomic number of 3 and a weight of about 7, as opposed to 1. And we already see that in the lithium ion batteries that are on our laptops. It's the other possible way of storing energy in matter that's about as light as compact as you can get. The point here is that we actually may be already seeing the beginnings of essentially a mature technology. And we can't see it yet because we're in this phase where the technology is still trying to change very fast to get there, and we're still sort of hypnotized by the belief that progress goes on forever. But the key from here forward may be actually re-understanding what progress means in terms of sort of trying to get somewhere specific rather than infinitely changing. This would also shed light on the unsustainability of what we're doing right now. It actually would turn out that it's inevitable, appropriate, and necessary that everything we are doing right now is still completely unsustainable. Because things are changing so fast and things are still so inefficient that nothing we're doing right now we will want to keep around for very long. But we suddenly can make these leaps to get much more efficient very quickly. We've got so much inefficiency that in the 70s, when the price of oil went up a tiny bit, the efficiency ripples that came from that actually flattened the per capita demand for energy. Now, populations continue to grow, so the demand has been continuing to grow. But just from that little bit of price signal, we stopped using more energy per person, and we have lots of places we could go to take and reduce how much we use. Another example of that would be what's called buckyballs, or Buckminster Fering. It's a molecule composed of 60 carbon atoms in a sphere that you can also then make tubes out of. And it's basically one of Buckminster Fuller's geodesic spheres, and chemists developed it because of knowing about Buckminster geometry. They sort of got onto it. This represents another like order of magnitude beyond the carbon fiber technology that we're just now not even really deploying. Because as you go from a linear fiber to these cylindrical tube structures, your strength to weight ratio goes up again. It's unlikely that we're going to do any better than the C60 based materials. When you arrange carbon into these tubes at the nano level, it's really unlikely that we're going to figure out a way, because unless somebody invents some new matter, I mean, you can look at the puzzle and these are the pieces, you can put them together in these ways. The other place that we're just beginning to notice things is in what's being called biomimicry. Janine Benyus has popularized this. And it's the idea that we can learn from nature, you know, Velcro and all kinds of things, iridescent colors off of organisms that diffract light that we could use into the paint. There's all kinds of examples. And it would be with biodiversity as if we're burning down the Library of Alexandria before we learn to read. Which is one of the arguments you can make to a venture capitalist about why you should preserve biodiversity. But what I'm suggesting with meta-nature is actually different in a fundamental way than what Janine is suggesting with biomimicry. Biomimicry is essentially Aristotelian. It says that biology is out there, we can learn from it, and we can kind of copy it. Meta-nature is essentially kind of Platonic. It says there are these forms that both nature and potentially humanity can see into if we look with the right orientation and discover. And the possibility of these things existing is built into the nature of existence. So we're not just copying from nature, we're actually bringing forth something that is in the same spirit, but in order to do it, we have to kind of adopt an attitude of kind of reverence and humility and discovery, rather than sort of the clever monkey by brute force trying to sort of impose on top of nature. The thing that gives me the confidence to say this is a diagram that I discovered about 22 years ago, actually. And it's basically completion of it's Pythagoras and Leonardo combined.
Jesus Christ, it looks like.
Exactly. We actually get the Christ on the cross as well as the three fundamental families of symmetry and the golden mean twice. And basically, if you start with the golden mean and the four simplest shapes you could make in plane geometry and use the golden mean twice, this geometry, this little puzzle, will come out of it. And it came one night. I'd been struggling for months trying to scribe over Leonardo's drawing. It came at 3:45 a.m. The triangle, the square, and the pentagram. Yeah. and I won't say more about it tonight, but that experience 22 years ago of discovering this thing is what really gave me the sort of visceral intention to go down this path and start thinking about this stuff. Incidentally, that chemistry spiral came within about 3 months at the same time, and another one about Newtonian physics. And I had transiting in the sky, Sun and Uranus conjoined exactly opposite my Sun. And for about 3 months, it was like I was just plugged into a light socket, and these three things came in that period. So that, in a nutshell, is sort of the argument for metanature. And the way I'm going to be presenting it, for instance, the Tech Museum next week, is that it represents kind of a synthesis of these two poles that are not being reconciled right now between the sort of deep environmental movement and the really hardcore growth capitalist movement that seem to be not talking to each other very well. And in a way, it's the kind of optimism of the entrepreneurial, high-tech kind of, you know, build the technology is the only way to get through. We cannot go backwards. Given our number even now, much less where we're going, there is no way we can go backwards to nature, to some better pastoral situation. The only way that humanity can make it at all, probably, is to build a climax technology. But at the same time, the one other measure of whether or not we succeed during our lifetime will be how much of biodiversity we preserve for future generations. Those will be the two measures for future generations of this period. And we essentially have to do both of those things at the same time. It's important to recognize that as frightening as these graphs are, they haven't actually happened yet. But the time remaining is very small. It's measured in years, few single-digit years. It's not far out there. We're in this logarithmic phase where things can explode so fast that it catches off guard. So I'm actually going to one more metaphor from nature, and that is to come back and talk about economics, which I think is the leverage point in all of this, because the other trends, when you really get into them, it seems as if everything is driven right now by the logic of financial markets. People blame corporations, but I know people at very high levels in corporations, and I do these thought experiments where if I was the president of a very, very big corporation with my values, I could do nothing. If I started to go outside of the game rules, my profit level would go down and I'd be out in 3 months. So the logic of the global financial system is the thing that enforces behavior and constrains everybody's ability to do anything. There have been some very interesting moves at the margin. There are a number of interesting things that are sort of under the radar about the possibility of introducing trade credits that would have essentially negative interest attached to them backed by commodities. And these things already could sort of rationalize barter that's being done between corporations now. And if they came in, they could, particularly if we went into a global financial meltdown, because one of the things about our money system is it's faith-based money. It's basically our money is based on the belief that the money's worth something. There is no underlying material substrate that it's linked to.
We're off the gold standard.
Yeah, and what Bernard proposes to do is, instead of putting it back on the gold standard, put us back on a market basket of commodities, which is the real underlying stuff that everything is trading on. And I think it could very easily happen in response to crisis that could very easily happen. It's very clear the price of oil is about to go up. I'm going to do one other little thought experiment on economics with you, and that is to think about the metaphor in nature of accumulation of value. So if you have a field, like a burned field or a former pasture, and it's going to start undergoing succession, and some shrubs and bushes start growing, and then small trees and so on, and each year that this happens, the plants that are deployed there are able to harness more sunlight as they put up more structure and capture more photons, and so there's a sort of time value of sunlight that you could think of as kind of supporting the idea of the time value of money in our society. That the longer you have some wealth, some industrial capability, the more you should be due interest, you should be due return on it, because you can deploy more, it can grow. And you're growing this infrastructure. And so you could completely rationalize and defend our existing growth-based economic system based on watching nature take over this field. And that argument could be really embraced by economists who probably love it. And I think I should publish that one in just that form. And then in the second one, point out that eventually that the get to a climax first, and there's no more succession going on. You've deployed as much as you can in that space, and somehow nature will smoothly switch from a system that was based on sort of growth and succession to one that's based on kind of a sustainable, stable state. And one of the other characteristics of the inflection point on the S-curve very likely is the point where society somehow switches its operating system, its game rules, from one that is purely based on growth to one that's starting to look towards stability or towards a long-term stable state. And actually, it probably doesn't switch all at once, because you actually need the high growth to get through the point of inflection, but you need the high growth aimed at the long-term technology that you're trying to build out at first very quickly. One example of this technology that almost nobody knows about is some carbon sequestration technology that I discovered a little while ago. And a friend of mine who came to Planet Work had set out to work on the global warming problem. And he ended up discovering that you can actually take biomass, heat it, drive hydrogen off, take the charcoal that's left over, some nitrogen out of the air, put it all together, and CO2 coming off a power plant will precipitate out on the charcoal. And just putting charcoal in the ground, it turns out, is kind of like building a coral reef for soil organisms. And the organisms that start growing on that will start taking more carbon out of the air than even what you put there. So at the kilogram scale in the university, we now have proved technology that will go carbon negative using coal and biomass. So this is an example both of a bridge technology, because for 50 or 100 years we're going to need to use that coal to wean ourselves off of the petrochemical addiction. But at the same time, we start to build out a technology that will sequester carbon out of the air, reduce the carbon, and fix the other huge chemical imbalance we caused with carbon. We put too much carbon in the air during industrialization. We also took too much carbon out of the soil. So this is a technology you can use to rebalance those two huge material imbalances of industrial agriculture, restore the soil, rebalance the air, and put in place a biomass system that, in the absence of coal, would still be using some biomass to make hydrogen, to make biodiesel. So it builds a hydrogen economy. It does biodiesel, which is a really easy bridge. I know I'm covering a lot of ground, but this is a very concrete example of a technology that, again, has just in time has come in and promises to be able to transform the industrial infrastructure in just the way that we would need to pull it off to solve one of the problems, actually two of them, both a big piece of the energy, a big piece of the global warming. So
I'm wondering if some of the in our discussion period, some of the points that you might, just in terms of time, if you opened up to discussion at a certain point, you'd probably be able to answer some or bring up some of the further points within the discussion.
I'm going to throw one last thing out, which kind of I would do for a PCC audience, and I'm not intending to do first round for other audiences. So pretty much everything I've been talking about up to this point, while it uses some novel diagrams to talk about it, and with the exception of a little synchronicity story about the Vitruvian Man, is pretty well rooted in science, maybe too rooted in science for most audiences. In thinking about the global situation, there's another perspective that I find interesting that comes very much from PCC. it seems as if every time we come to a fork in the road, and there's one fork that would go to a stable, steady progression towards where we want to go, and there's another fork that goes towards crisis, we seem to go, ooh, crisis. And kind of, you know, it's as if this administration is just, you know, the poster child for that. It's like if you picked, you know, and this Pope, and, you know, any number of things in the world, if you just picked the thing that would accelerate us towards the wall, you know, you couldn't have designed it better than what we thought. At the same time, if you look around at all different cultures, there's this practice, really, of in order for an individual to get to a higher state of spiritual integration, understanding, there's a kind of death and rebirth experience that the individual undergoes. And across many, many cultures, the born-again thing seems to be there in one form or another. At the same time, if you look across many cultures, maybe not all of them, there seem to be prophecies that seem more and more to be speaking about our time. And in some cultures, they speak of the end of the world. And in some cultures, they speak of the birth of a new world. And frequently, they seem to speak of both. And if you go to the kind of Teilhard de Chardin view of emergent global consciousness that many of us are sympathetic with, it still remains a kind of abstract intellectual idea. And so it seems plausible, at least, you know, speculation, that in order for the global system to kind of jump to some new level of order at a deep, visceral sense, that we set ourselves up to undergo some sort of global near-death experience. And that at some level, the shadow of this thing may shine sort of back in time, and people come encounter with it, in contact with it, and those encounters touch them so deeply that the cultures recognize it and elevate what these people say, but then whatever they say is totally incomprehensible and gets filtered through the cultural context and held in that cultural context, so that whatever was being prophesied retrospectively would validate all the prophecies, but prospectively would be different than what any of them think. And in fact, could even be some situation where all of these different prospective anticipations are part of what's necessary to bring the event about. So that whatever it is that we're trying to undergo, in some sense everybody does know their part, but nobody knows what they're doing or where it's really going. And if I try and imagine, you know, what could happen that would fulfill this, as Terence McKenna says, in a happy way. the only thing I've been able to imagine is some sort of global economic meltdown and transformation. Because we live so much not in the material world, we live in the symbolic world of money, that if that system was deeply shaken, it would be the end of the world for many people. It would be experienced that way. And yet, again and again, when you get in conversations with people trying to work on all these problems, the one thing that blocks us from actually being able to deal with the real situation, and the one thing that could change overnight, even though we think that it's intractable, is essentially our game rules and our conceptions. So, with that, I'm going to conclude. Yes.
Robert, what are the clock time structure for the evening better than I do? What's
we're going to start at 7:30. He's going to talk till quarter after
8:35 right now.
So we'll go for have a 15-minute discussion, 20-minute discussion, and then we can quit around 9 o'clock. Okay.
9 o'clock is great.
Great. Okay. So please, anybody that would like to...
I'd like to thank you for a really stunning presentation that says a lot in a short space of time, and I'm really fascinated. I hope it gets published in lots of pictures. And so that's just what I want to do. It's a true PCT formulation.
I just think the intellectual capacity to put those types of things together are to a certain extent dependent on a kind of, should I put it, like a kind of archetypal consciousness that's been forged through a lot of experiences that permit a way of, you know, sort of Batesonian shifts of levels, so that you can, if I think about the way in which you did that kind of synthesis of opposites to get to this perspective and trying to put a name to it, in some ways what you're suggesting is a kind of a prenatal understanding of the crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, many people have had the idea that we're in a perinatal, you know, world crisis, which it certainly is. But by also thinking of it as a prenatal, that is, that there's this embryonic development that's taking place that is necessary to precipitate the perinatal crisis, and then laying out these factors, it provides more clues to the picture than have been on the table before. And I suspect that even the ability to see that is to a certain extent mediated by non-empirical and non-rational factors in your own development.
Yeah, I would say that's a safe bet.
I've heard some of the personal anecdotes that give some background, which I won't share. But since I use this opportunity to jump in, if I might, let's speak into the system.
Yes, rising.
So many things. But it seems to me that, first of all, you know, the Global Footprint Network, called, or Association.
Sure.
I'll send you a link. They have a journal, an online journal, and so on, that give us a lot of the graphs you're talking about resource consumption for countries, and anyway, it's nicely accessible. But it seems that even if this climax technology happens, even if the financial market crashes or the rules of the game change, unless the global population is somehow cut by a factor of at least half within 10 years, it seems that just the sheer weight of human biomass and its hunger for consumption will sink the biosphere if nothing else will. That's one thing that I'll, having said that, I'm wondering if you know Heinberg's book, Power Down, if you've seen that. So he goes through several scenarios. One of them is the worldview is your market-driven one. It's the first scenario, which basically just propels us into catastrophe as soon as we can. Second one is a technological quick fix, that, you know, we'll have new technologies to solve it all. Third one is power down, where we start to live sustainably and so on. And the only hope seems to be combining sustainability, powering down, with sort of climax technology. But he feels it's, he gives all sorts of reasons why he feels it's too late for that. And that the only thing that we should be, or the main thing we should be doing now is building arcs.
That's another character named Caldwell that puts that forward. He's got a book called the foundation.org. In the face of those arguments, there's really only faith, and I can't claim that it's right. I don't think you can get there by rationality alone. I don't think I got to any of this by rationality alone. I think most of the people, though, doing this big analysis have not spent a lot of time looking at the radically different view of what's possible. They tend not to be people who study Fuller. They tend not to be people who study permaculture. At this point, much of our impact is being driven far more by the logic of the fiscal system than by the actual needs of people if they weren't so desperately impoverished. And if a system could be brought in that actually brought enough resources to bring local renewal, there's a lot of ecological restoration that could be done. It's not tech, it's not expensive, it needs knowledge, it needs labor redeployed, and enough food to do it. It's been demonstrated in Amazonian Basin that a family that's been slashing and burning a hectare a year for food can live sustainably on 3 hectares if they can get tree crops reestablished. It takes about 2 years to reestablish. It's been demonstrated that you can reverse deserts if you deploy things properly. A lot of the projection of extinction, somewhere between a half and a third of the extinction projections come from global warming. If we can deploy this carbon negative technology quickly enough, we can put a cap on that, while also building a hydrogen economy. In some ways, I see those very negative predictions from really hard science people as useful if we can get the attention of the capitalists with it. On the other hand, I think we're probably more likely to get their attention with the scenario that has an upside than with coming to them with a story that says we're doomed. Because just psychologically, it's very hard for people to break out of denial to hear that. So whether or not I'm right, just tactically, it seems an optimistic story is better, more effective. And, pick the future you want to vote for. We don't know. And we don't know what kind of plague, the way things usually happens to populations when they get too big is disease. Mm-hmm. And with the transportation system the way it is in the planet, we had a story on the front page of the New York Times a week or two ago about Marburg virus. We could, that could happen too. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Jim, thanks. It was really fascinating, actually. And I wanted to confirm one thing about your thought experiment about CEOs and companies, because it's one of the reasons why I left. I just realized I could not change that environment. There was no way. It was too ingrained. So, but my question to you has to do with how much of this is unconscious and how much of it is conscious. How much... All of the other times that you've talked about all the other metaphors are sort of natural and unconscious in the way that they adapt to a situation, like the Kleinex forest or the bacteria and the CO2 crisis or the O2 crisis, all those things. And a lot of your language had a sort of teleological, some other consciousness at work moving through, like the technology trying to come into existence in a lot of ways. So just in your evaluation, how much of a conscious effort is going to actually play a big role in this, and how much of it is going to be spiritually or collectively and unconsciously propelled?
I guess let's take a couple of those points in order. My own view is certainly unfashionably teleological from the point of view of intellectual circles on the planet, although probably not from the mass popular consciousness witness, folks in vogue right now. And I think actually telling a better story for those populations may be part of what's needed, that is told at that kind of level. My own experience, as Rick alluded to, certainly has been informed by a sense of some larger intelligence in the whole thing at work. At the same time, it seems to me that the point of inflection, the mathematical point of inflection in the curve, is characterized, among other things, by a fairly rapid shift in conscious, intentional volition. So that up to that point, the thing is completely unconscious, as we've seen.
Yeah.
And at that point, what characterizes the point itself is a self-reflective understanding of where we could be going in the face of an otherwise hopeless situation. And that the hopelessness of the situation provides a strong enough motive force to drive a sudden outbreak of cultural reorientation. With or without apparently external simultaneous crisis experience. I don't know if that, you know, is part of what has to happen, whether it happens in slow motion, people are having it different ways all over the place, or whether we really have one day where the, you know, through the media we all have this experience in unison of like, holy shit, and everything is changed by it. I know we don't have a whole hell of a lot of time to get there. The experience, though, that I've had in non-ordinary states is that is how we do it. And it's the only thing sufficient to snap us out of what we're doing. And that it is essentially the analog or the octave of the individual perinatal birth and rebirth experience. And that what is most critical, maybe, is awareness of enough people in advance of that and sort of preparation to be midwives to it, so that we're able to use that opportunity as an opportunity when most of the population will necessarily feel that it is absolutely hopeless. But that may be the only thing that can break us out of the other patterns.
Thanks for the hope. Glad to hear something hopeful. I was glad to hear sort of the logic of capitalism come in there, and I was glad when you got to consciousness, which is kind of where the discussion is going now, because what I was thinking while you were talking, pretty much the whole time, is, you know, we think in PCC a lot, as you know, is that the crisis is as much a crisis, you know, consciousness as it is a material crisis. Mm-hmm. So, and I think what I hear you saying is that we just need to sort of look at the cause and effect of that, perhaps a little differently, or just open it up to a more reciprocal kind of cause and effect between the consciousness crisis and the material crisis, and perhaps a new way of organizing things materially will then feed back and help change consciousness, such that we don't just repeat the same sort of devouring the planet with new technologies.
Yeah, for instance, if you dropped infinite energy on the system right now, it would devour the planet faster. It's not an energy problem. Obviously, you know, I'm dyed in the wool PCC. I've been through a lot of these experiences. I guess I've gotten to the point where I see all of it as absolutely of a piece. That I don't see any of this stuff as separate. That it's one process, and basically, you know, there's that joke, one planet, one experiment. Well, it's sort of like, you know, one egg, one birth. I mean, we either do this and we complete this whole trajectory, or the thing is stillborn. And so there's a tremendous opportunity, but it's really all or nothing. That you know, we're at this point where all of these forces are that serious.
I have to say, stillborn at this point for ourselves. I mean, the planet's not necessarily going to die.
If you trace it back and you think about this whole process as involving all of the deposits of fossil fuels that have been put in place since life started growing on this planet, and you know, all of those conditions that had to be organized in just that way to make it possible for there to be this little efflorescence where time is successively shortened for each piece of it in this sort of log curve. You could make a fairly good case that planets get an opportunity to do this once. And I can't prove that, but I'd really take the argument. It, at the very least, what is at stake is the impoverishment of all future humans. That we either pull this off or we knock out the ability for technology that leads to all of the things that we've experienced. And probably you fall into an incredibly violent, destructive anarchy. Because if you don't make the jump, and you're left with a huge population of humans and very small amounts of resources, that system will not go to a pretty place.
Dark ages.
Yeah, well, makes the dark ages look good.
Yeah.
Was anybody else? My turn?
Frank, and then Erica.
Okay. I got a couple comments that kind of dovetail on hers, and then I just want to make a comment that's separate from that. One way we can think about it is, of what you just said, one egg, one birth, right? That's from our little perspective. What if the whole universe? What if we're discovering, it's interesting that as the midst of all this is happening, two other interesting things are happening. One, we're midway through the sun's life. So we're right at mid-age. We're at the Uranus off for the sun, right? We're at halfway for the sun. And then the other one is we're discovering extrasolar planets. So it's sort of like, isn't that interesting? Talk about timing. Right at the time that our egg is either going to hatch or die, we're realizing, there might be some other eggs out there.
First visual image last week.
Of extrasolar
really?
Planets.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Jupiter class visual images?
Yeah, and they've been discovering them for the past, maybe just 10 years.
97.
Maybe just since the Uranus Neptune
anniversary.
Triple conjunctions where they came.
With Jupiter, right.
Yeah, so awfully interesting. So then the other piece, if you come outside of just our little neighborhood and you think of it as the whole universe wants to do this, and the universe is trying to do it all over the place, wherever people got to this stage, right? Then you kind of get a little broader perspective. It's a little bit less of a bummer if we don't make it, because maybe somewhere else will make it.
Oh, that I grant
yeah.
you. I'm just saying,
yeah.
you know,
well, let
if
me
it
finish,
doesn't
let
happen in parallel, doesn't mean this one doesn't matter.
No. I'm just that's sort of my counter comment to that perspective, because that perspective was just us, bummer, right? When I'm saying, well, maybe there's some other places, and it's awfully interesting that we're getting this knowledge at this time. So that's one point. And the other point was that relates to this train of thinking is it's awfully interesting that the way the universe is designed is that the nearest, Alpha Centauri is 4 million light years away, right?
4 million,
okay, that's right. So in other words, and that's
four
the closest...
Four light years away.
And that's the closest one, right? So if we self-destruct, if we completely pollute ourselves, like let's say we dropped a bunch of nuclear bombs tomorrow, we're far enough away from any of the other egg pods that we won't pollute them. So it's sort of a crap in your own diapers type metaphor, right? That if we crap, it just dirties our diapers. It doesn't dirty the other diapers of the other babies, right? So I don't know. I'm just looking at these Pythagorean design parameters of the whole system, and from those pieces of data, it makes me think that the Pythagorean design parameters are kind of interesting. So that's food for thought for the group. And then the other comment was, which was the comment that I wanted to make, but Carolyn's comment made me think of all that stuff, was the gold standard, when Nixon was president and George Shultz, the guy who helped Arnold Schwarzenegger, by the way, George Shultz was his Treasury Secretary in 1971-72, we went off the gold standard, and therefore the whole global economy went off the gold standard. So that created the liquidation of money for this trend that you're talking about, of the global casino. Because it was decoupled from the conservative dynamic of a gold time.
Although it goes back to the shortly after the turn of the century, really, when the whole system was...
Well, Bretton Woods, but be careful, because Bretton Woods was a gold standard system. So the World War II still had the conservative dynamic that prevented the rapid, this thing, that prevented the logarithmic curve in the financial casino that you're describing. So anyway, my final point is just simply that, guess what? 2006-2007 is the exact same transit as when we went off the gold standard. 1971-72 was Saturn off Neptune, and then we got Saturn off Neptune 2006-2007. So it would be kind of like the karmic return for that going off the gold standard. So it would just be, in an astrological perspective, for the karmic consequences of going off the gold standard, 2006, 2007 would be the great time for the karmic consequences to sort of flourish.
Don't say that at your museum talk.
Yeah. Those are my thoughts.
Green Spade,
these are PCC.
Totally PCC. Private.
This is the other church.
Museum talk. The other church.
I'm intending to kind of take a lesson from Rick and put forward the book that the venture capitalist can read that tries to reconcile the kind of World Watch and VC world. That's really science-based, that's got some novel diagrams, that's very upside on technology, and get that one out there and not put any of this sort of teleological, esoteric stuff out.
Psychedelic Pythagoreanism.
if I put that one out first, we wouldn't have PCC, at least.
Exactly. And in terms of economics, while I agree that gold sort of was the final untethering of the thing, really you have to go back to a system where the money is three things. It's the means of exchange, measure of value, and store of value. All three of those right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you really have to go back to times when those things were separated differently to see what it looked like to have systems that were functioning differently. Because gold doesn't really measure all the stuff that's being transacted in the economy at the corporate level. And a market basket trade credit would be very different than a gold-backed dollar. Gold-backed dollar was still really a debt-based monetary system. We've had that for a long time, at least since Jekyll Island, and way back before that. Anyway, let's take another comment. In terms of the big cosmological view, I don't know. You know, I'm personal friends with people who've had all kinds of abduction experiences. If you listen, you know, we've studied UFOs. If you take seriously the primary source data, either there's nothing there or there's a whole zoo and we're some sort of terrarium and they're all like buying tickets to watch what's going to happen. But, you know, it seems to remind me of one of these experiments in Yellowstone where they're watching the bears and weren't allowed to mess with them too much. You know, if there are all kinds of other life forms watching us, they seem to have a policy of keeping their hands off.
Well, no, but that's assuming they're more advanced. My comments were that they're at the same stage as we are.
I could also, you know, philosophically it's possible to imagine that I Love Lucy signals will reach us, you know, that ours reaches them, and,
yeah,
you know, we'll both find, you know, at some moment, you know, we'll all find people in the 50s all at once, you know, the radio signals will hit everybody all at once. Holy
whoa,
shit!
Wow.
You know, exactly in parallel. That's why we haven't heard anything before. You know, but on the other hand, there's those views that the reason we don't hear any civilizations is because they get to a certain point and nuke themselves or something.
And there's also the point of view that there's almost for sure other, you call them life forms, but that are quite conscious of what's happening, watching what's happening, and are keeping their hands off, but aren't necessarily located in a particular star system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There's also, you know, a truly radical view. The whole thing's made out of mind, and, you know.
I think I just wasn't clear on meta-nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how it was actually different from technology helping evolve something, or the carbon example that you had that seems to be, like, reverse course, or...
Well, it's... In many ways, it's just a frame, but if you were to try and frame the current view of technology among technologists, and I want to separate life support technology from other kinds of technology, which may go I don't know where. The kind of underlying tenet of modernity is this idea of progress. And that progress is this infinite vector that kind of goes up and out, and, you know, it goes to Star Trek or it goes to whatever, and it may go those places. But what's missing from that, and what is seems to be on collision course with the finite resources of the planet, is how we do stable sustainable, prosperous life support on the planet. And partly in order to understand that, you really need to start looking into matter. You know, what does it mean to be embodied? What does it mean to live in matter? And when you start really looking at that, what I have found is that it's kind of like a puzzle where the limits are not the sort of negative limits of the limits to growth crowd. They're limits of getting to a state of completion where the enterprise of humanity of solving the problem of being in matter would actually be completed. And we would get there. And we would unbuild the rat race. That as you got to solutions that were elegant enough, they would also get successively more long-lived. So that if you could put silicon together to make a panel that wasn't encapsulated in carbon that was going to degrade in 20 years, but was actually encapsulated either with fluorinated carbon or with some other silicon compound, or you were able to put the matter together in just the right way that you made a silicon panel that would last 1,000 years. Now, and I think it's probably 200 years before doing that. I suspect the curve, if you look backwards at the Industrial Revolution from here, and you look forward, it's more or less symmetrical in time, but that as far forward in time as we look backward to things taking off about 1650, we could be at a place where we are deploying technology that is completely clean, that we have sort of essentially two different loops, one loop that's completely interactive with nature and absolutely clean, and another set of loops that are completely separate from the biosphere and completely reuse elements in them perfectly and only engage in those kinds of chemistry that we understand as equally elegant to what nature's doing. And that the cycles of those things have become so energy efficient and so durable that we essentially no longer need to engage in most of what we call the economy. We spend our time gardening because we largely enjoy it, looking after the kids, doing craftsmanship, intellectual activities, and there's some new enterprise for humanity that is not about, like, how do we solve the problem of being in matter? And I don't know what that is. I think to be even able to see the next phase beyond the point we're at right now, up until this point, has been essentially invisible. It's as if we've been looking forward and not able to see first past Y2K, and now that we're past it, you know, now we're sort of looking forward and seeing what looks like, you know, hopelessness under Saturn and Neptune, it's appropriate. But, you know, with good reason. And what I'm trying to point to is the possibility of something that's completely the opposite of that hopelessness. And that we can already understand within the technological frame we have. You know, Moore's Law, we see the end of it. The computer doubling we've been experiencing. We're coming up on the end of that process. It's possible that we're actually going to finish solving most of the problems in matter, and that's not going to be where our fascination and problem is. I'm not saying there won't be a whole other set of, you know, phenomenological scientific questions and challenges, but I don't think they're going to be about chemistry and physics or even biology.
I have one little comment. Is it about nine?
Just enough time for you to ask a question.
It's actually a kind of history of ideas comment, which is sort of a funny thing to bring up in a presentation like this. It's like, you know, as the Titanic is going down, talking about interesting, you know, parallel trajectories. But
the Titanic is not going down. That's the whole point.
Well, at one level, the Titanic could be going down, and something else could be. That whole curve that you talked about, that sense of progress, indefinite, is a whole solar fantasy of it's a fantasy when the sun is going up and up, and it doesn't take into account that the solar logos hero has to descend, has to go down, and that may be mythically the point that we're just need to prophesy. But this is just, I think, a point that you'll be interested in. It was 30 years ago, like 74, 75, when I heard Stan in the big house at Esalen describe a conversation he had with, and I believe it was Jonas Salk, saying that if you looked at the graphs of the different curves involving what I particularly remember, it's been 30 years ago, but what I particularly remember was the pollution curves for the globe at that point, and he said the one thing that it paralleled was that and I think other variables along that line was the chicken embryo curves of cell pollution within the egg that happened just prior to the egg cracking, and I've always remembered that. It was such an arresting image. It was a prenatal, perinatal model for the global crisis. And Stan would be, of course, so interested in what you just presented tonight. And, you know, he's also really interested in Bernard Laterre's work. And, you know, I think it would be really great when he can hear what you've just said. But it's interesting that someone, and I think it was Jonas Salk, had a kind of parallel intuition. But without all the pieces that you put together. Anyway, it's a kind of a history of ideas type of comment about a very urgent paradigm shift that you articulated here that is kind of beside the point. But I just thought you might be interested in that background.
One little riff I didn't put out in this that I'd sort of, I mean, the original one was discredited. The biology recapitulates ontology, you know, the
ontogeny,
the Lamarckian biologist who put that forward. But in a way, this is sort of suggesting that evolution recapitulates. Let's mix up which is which then. Phylogeny, I guess.
Phylogeny.
Phylogeny, yeah, because
it would be
so this would be
the other
way
around
it, yeah. Because it would be suggesting that essentially the whole of the global system seen as one organism is in some sense, you know, recapitulating a chicken egg.
That is the same idea. That is phylogeny. It's just that here the phylum is the whole species, the whole planet, instead of just one species. Still the same idea. It's the whole phylum, in this case, the whole recapitulating what we see in an individual, namely an egg.
Right, but the original formulation of it, I thought, was that the individual biological growth...
Yeah, that's right. It's Ernst Haeckel.
Recapitulated the evolutionary record. And since
it's
staying the other way around,
right,
the evolutionary record is going to now recapitulate in some sense the individual embryonic.
Right.
And in fact, I know people that are like looking at exactly that kind of thing, of like looking back at stages of embryonic development, late fetal development, saying, well, what happens? You know, can we learn from that about our situation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's lessons for everyone. So I think we should...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maybe